Interview with Orestes Mihaly, November 12th, 2008, in Armonk, New York, by Kenneth Durr. All right, great. Well, I want to start with a little bit of background. We don't have to do the full I started out as a child, but I want to get a little bit about your education and how you got pointed in the direction of this career.
Well, I went to college, NYU College, Washington Square College, and after graduating from Washington Square College, I went to NYU Law School. And after getting out of law school, at that time it was very difficult finding any kind of position. The graduates were really suffering from lack of placements in any kind of a legal firm.
Was this the mid-50s?
Yeah, it was probably 55, actually, okay. Something like that. And I was fortunate enough to get a placement through the school, and they referred me to the Attorney General's office, and I became a special deputy attorney general or something like that for a year, presumably.
So you're on the staff.
I'm on the staff of the Attorney General's office, and at that point, Jacob Javits was still the Attorney General. And during that period of time, I also was taking the bar exams because I wasn't really admitted to the bar at that point. Then I took the New York and Connecticut bars and passed them, thank God. And then eventually worked my way up to become an assistant attorney general and so forth and so on. And I stayed there for from 1975 to 1987.
What size was the staff when you came on? How many people are we talking about?
Well, in the Securities Bureau, there were probably about six or seven lawyers and four, five accountants and the bureau chief probably and myself. It was something like that.
Who was the bureau chief?
John Kelly was probably the first one that I was the bureau chief. He didn't last long. He ran for judge and became a judge. Mm. And then there was Sid Tartikoff. Sid Tartikoff was a very nice old gentleman. Then he became ill and he left in about 2 years or so. And then Carl Madonick. Carl Madonick was a younger, vibrant sort of guy. And he became the bureau chief and lasted until after the Lindsay election. John Lindsay was the mayor, ran for mayor, and Carl was very active in his campaign. And actually so was I. And Carl became a commissioner of housing or something like that. And he left. So then Dave Klorman became the attorney general in charge in the office, and Dave stayed until I took over and became the assistant attorney general in charge of the Bureau of Securities, and that's the timeline.
Sometime in the mid-70s, I guess.
I became bureau chief, let me see, 1975. Okay. I was appointed by Lefkowitz.
Okay. Did you go right into, it sounds like you did a one-year sort of internship deal or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Did you go right into the Securities Bureau then?
Oh, yes, I did. That's where I started out, in the Securities Bureau.
What was it that prepared you for that? Why did they put you in there?
I have no idea. They probably thought that there was a need for some young man to maybe, shuffle the papers around a little bit. But actually, I think I was... My first assignment in doing that this was later. It was a different time period. I was going to refer to listening at wiretaps, mm-hmm. but that came later. Okay. Yeah.
So you started out.
I started out just doing things, and sitting in on hearings and. and actually watching the in those days the accountants, they didn't have you know, ways that they do their checking of the accounts. Now, they used to have the books. You brought the book in from the boiler room, and you put it on the desk. You went through every entry in the book and the ledgers and so forth and so on. It was a tedious job, and the accountants were well versed in how to find out what was wrong with what they saw in the books, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And and there were some great accountants in that. Barney Abramson was one of them, and Abe Pass. Gumbar, a guy named Gumbar. They were fantastic people to decipher what was wrong in the books of a particular small brokerage, usually a small brokerage, so-called boiler room.
Right. So you got introduced to boiler rooms pretty quickly.
Right away.
How did those typically come to your attention? Did you go out and find them, or was this all complaint-driven?
Well... Depending on what the time period was, I guess. It was probably early on, it was complaint-driven. And later on, we became more aggressive in the things and knew where to look for them, you know. So that's the way it turned out to be.
Tell me about some of the early experiences. I'm sure that, you know, when you were young and you're just doing this, some of them must have stuck in your mind.
Well, there was one of the earlier ones was involved. One of the earlier ones that I, when I was still a young member of the bar, I first came into the office and John Kelly was had a case involving the Alaska Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, and there was a fellow by the name of Walter Tellier, who was a owned a couple of brokerage houses out of Hartford, Connecticut, actually. And the office decided to prosecute or to look into his operations, and they actually sent out Kelly and Casagrande, the accountant, to the West Coast, where the information was with respect to the AT&T Telegraph Company, supposedly, in Canada.
So you're looking at the securities they're issuing, I guess.
Yes.
Okay.
And meanwhile, Kelly told me to, and this is, I was a young guy then, John Kelly told me that I had to interview witnesses for the trial, you know, people who had bought the stock and were wiped out because it was a fraud. Mm-hmm. So I proceeded to call people in and interview them. And one of the people that I was able to interview was an old Scandinavian fellow who was a tugboat captain on the Hudson River. And he had a daughter or sister or something who was like crippled, and he was supporting her, and he had been hoodwinked by the boiler room salesman into buying this particular stock. So, naturally, I thought, using my wealth of knowledge at that time as to what would be a good witness in this particular case, I decided to recommend that he become a witness. And the judge had only limited Kelly to only having two witnesses of that type to testify at the trial. This was not a criminal trial. This was a trial for an injunctive proceeding.
Okay.
And so... I told Kelly when he came back, and he said, good work, and now he's going to put him on the stand, and he did. And the guy was fantastic and proceeded to tell his story and how he was hoodwinked and about his cousin or his nephew or niece or whatever it was, how she had been damaged by his investment, and the attorney for the defendant, as Kelly walked back to his seat, he said, "Where did you get that guy?" He said, and as a result of that testimony, to a great degree, I think, we did get a verdict of getting an injunction, and actually the judge only allowed for a five-year injunction. In those days, there were permanent injunctions and there were less than permanent injunctions. And in this particular case, the judge ruled a five-year injunction. And when Tellier came in with his lawyer to sign the papers consenting to the injunction or whatever it was, and the Tellier asked Kelly, he says, I got this coin. Now let's flip the coin. This is heads, it's 5 years. Tails, it's a permanent injunction. Naturally, Kelly refused, and he became only subject to a five-year injunction.
Yeah. I can't see any reason why he would have taken that.
Yeah.
So you got as close as you could to widows and orphans, I guess, is the point when you're going out and looking for people. That gets to making your case. I mean, was this a difficult thing to do at that point? Was it hard to get sentiment on your side when you're prosecuting some of these people?
Well, in my early days, I was more concerned about my being able to get across to the jury that what I was saying was worthy of their concern, and we were not trained too well. We were like neophytes, or at least I was a neophyte, and some of the, like Kelly, he was more mature attorney, left the office to become a judge. I was just like a 27-year-old guy or something like this, so I was certainly didn't have any training in trial practice, mm-hmm. let alone a criminal prosecution. And so you sort of felt your way around and asked the assistant DAs how to do this and what to say and how to sum up. And it was like trial by error, so to speak. And it was kind of difficult.
I would think that you would have left some of that up to the DAs or the assistant DAs.
Well, depending on who the attorney general was, if the attorney general decided that he wanted his office to take a case under the Martin Act, mm-hmm. because the attorney general, the Martin Act statute in New York provides that the attorney general's office has direct criminal prosecution powers, and so if the attorney general usually is running for office sometime in the future, and he wants his name to become known in the press, and one of the ways to become known is to have cases brought and headlines returned that says that such and such attorney general's office put somebody in jail, and that was the main thrust of becoming having the office prosecute mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. You were working for Lefkowitz at this point? Was he
probably at this point Lefkowitz, yes.
Would he step in and take these things when you got into court sometimes?
No. I mean, he personally himself? Yeah. No, not at all. No. Okay. It was all the bureau chief, whoever the bureau chief might have been. If it wasn't myself, it would be me or one of the staff of the bureau that would be prosecuting. Lefkowitz or Abrams would be certainly knowledgeable about what we were doing and encouraging us, etc. But they didn't go to the court.
Well, what's involved in busting a boiler room? I mean, did you actually go in like Elliot Ness and the Untouchables?
In some cases, we did. Oh, yeah, definitely. We went in there with either process servers or police. At different times, we had actually state police assigned to our bureau, and they would participate in any raids, so-called, that we made. Mm-hmm. One of the, I think the most significant cases was a case called, involved Mineral Resources Corporation. This was after many years of uranium mines and things such as that, where the boiler room was selling, you know, interest in uranium mines, etc. But they sort of ran out of the uranium business, and they figured that they were going to come up with something new, and they came up with precious metal that was supposedly lithium metal or something that was supposedly in cans, and you bought an interest in these cans of
tantalum.
Tantalum, that's what it was. Yes, tantalum, and. We knew that this boiler room was particularly doing this solicitation of investments in tantalum, and we knew, of course, where the boiler room operation was. It was off of Lower Broadway on a side street, and we had several police and men and women, and. Just went into the place and arrested them and took them out in the paddy wagon, literally in the paddy wagon, took them down to the jailhouse.
So what would you find when you went into this place? I mean, you walk in the front door, is it just a place of business like any other?
Well, I didn't participate in going into this particular one, but I did others. And you just walk in and ask for the manager. And identify yourself and then tell them that we're here to serve subpoenas or we're here to put you under arrest. One of the two. Usually when the arrest situation, we would have the police with us would be able to actually make an arrest and do whatever was appropriate with respect to that. So anyway, this going back to the tantalum situation, there were about 35 people that were taken out in the wagon at this particular point. And in the night court, they were arraigned in night court in the building where the Tombs prison is in Lower Broadway, next to where Lefkowitz's office used to be. And it was a scene out of it was a wild scene. They were like my two deputies who were representing the people. And I was in the court also, and the attorneys for these 35 people, and as the assistant attorney general would make a statement, all of the other people in the courtroom, the defendants would give out a moan, but that was not true, no, you know. And then, on the other hand, if their lawyers would say something, they would almost be clapping. It was like a scene out of Dickens or something. It was just incredible. And this prosecution, they eventually were, you know, held for bail, et cetera, et cetera. And they got out on bail. And the trial came. And it was probably the longest trial in the history of prosecutions of boiler rooms and of securities frauds. It lasted. The trial took about 7 or 8 months.
Jeez.
And there was 34. And we had determined that we wanted to make sure that the boiler room operations, that the individual salespeople would know that they were also going to be subject to criminal prosecution. Prior to that, it was very rare that the salespeople were criminally prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the owners were, but not the salespeople.
Right.
This, we said we were going to eliminate boiler room operations by getting the salesmen to know that they were going to be subject to prosecution. And so that was the tactic that we had. And therefore, we had to have this trial, which included the not only the owners of the boiler room, but the 35 other people that were involved in it. And each of them had their own lawyers. The defense, the boiler operators, they had their lawyers, and basically almost each and every one of the other salesmen had their own lawyer. You can imagine what this looked like in a trial, in a courtroom.
And I mean,
it was like a Nuremberg trial.
And you're trying to make the case against every single individual.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're looking at who he called and what he said to so-and-so.
Yes, yes, yes. And there were several incidents that took place that sort of jammed up the trial. One where there was one attractive-looking woman who was one of the salespeople who was indicted and present in the courtroom, and she and one of the jurors, I guess, were making eyes at each other. It became known to us, and so we had to, you know, dismiss the juror and things like that. And it was really a fantastic situation, and it took about, as I say, close to 8 months to come to trial. And as the trial was ending and the summations were made, which took, you know, a long period of time to make summations, not only from the prosecutor's side, but from each and every of the attorneys having their own summations, it took a long period of time. And then they had the deliberations. And naturally, the jury went out, and the deliberations lasted for 2 weeks, because you could tell that basically how the jury was going through the deliberation, because you got down, you knew that they were coming down to the end of the line, so to speak. They knew that the owners of the boiler room seemed to have been taken care of, then the individuals, then they knew, we knew they were getting down to the final person, whoever it was. We didn't know who it was. So at that point, it was like later in the afternoon, and we knew that there was going to be a verdict pretty soon. And so everybody in the courtroom decided, there was one particular place where everybody went for a drink. And the defense counsel, the prosecutors, everybody. And probably, I hate to say this, but then we came back to the court. The only one that probably was sober was the judge and this court stenographer, you know, to one degree or another. And, of course, we got a verdict of guilty on all accounts.
Wow. Yeah. What we never talked about, what exactly the fraud was. They were calling people up and selling them shares of tantalum.
Right. Yeah, actually cans of tantalum, yeah.
Cans of tantalum. So they're selling commodities, I guess.
That's what they tried to allege, that wasn't a security. We beat that down, and we were successful in doing that.
So did the tantalum not exist? Is that the deal?
No, it existed, but it was scrap. It wasn't worth anything. It wasn't worth anything at all.
Okay.
And I also must point out that we were very, very much helped by the U.S. Attorney's Office, who also had an investigation going, and they had actually infiltrated the situation. They had actually spoken to the chief salesperson, and they got him to admit. In undercover operation with a wiretap and everything, that to very damaging evidence. I won't go through the exact English of it. It was pretty graphic, but and that was they actually had that tape, and we asked them to step aside and let us prosecute rather than they, and they did, and it was very gracious on their part, and we were able to come back with a successful verdict.
How much of your business, say in the 50s and the early to mid 60s and your earlier days in this position, how much of your work involved these kinds of boiler rooms, these kinds of frauds where you're bringing a case or you're trying to bring a case? And what other kinds of things were you involved in?
Well, besides boiler rooms, we also had the mafia in the boiler rooms. They could actually control several boiler rooms, and we were very, very into that. We were sort of there was a fellow named Carmine Lombardozzi who was the well-known mafia figure, He was also involved in that operation in Western New York. What's the name of that? Anyway, he was Lombardozzi was in charge. He ran several boiler rooms, and he had lieutenants under him. A fellow named Stanley Younger and others who James Gray was another boiler room operator that we actually busted to, went into the office and busted them. Mm-hmm. And then we the SEC we had sort of. They also prosecuted almost like simultaneously. Eddie Yeagerman was the SEC guy. He was he and Connolly, I think his name was Jim Connolly, also was his like assistant, and they were involved in these Lombardozzi boiler rooms, and they brought their cases in Hartford and I think Albany, somewhere upstate New Hampshire or Vermont. And we went along also to make an appearance in those cases, and we sort of had a cooperative approach with respect to that.
What was it like working with the SEC at that point?
It was it was okay. It was there was always a certain amount of jealousy, let's say, or you know who gets to go first type of thing. Mm-hmm. But they were pretty cooperative, and we were pretty cooperative with them. Later on in the career, actually, when Steve Hammerman was the SEC guy in New York. He later became the general counsel for Merrill Lynch. Steve Hammerman actually approached me and asked me whether we could do something together. You know, so we did. We actually picked out a particular case, and we both brought this same proceeding at the same time, had joint press releases and so forth and so on. That was not the usual case, but that was like the unusual case. But there was always a certain amount of a rivalry, let's put it that way, rivalry between the prosecutors. And the SEC naturally didn't have criminal jurisdiction. They, when right. they went up to Hartford or Vermont or wherever it was, they had to go to the U.S. attorneys up there, you know. And we just went ourselves to wherever we went. You know, we were the prosecutor. They weren't the prosecutors. They were asking for someone to prosecute right. on their behalf.
If there's something going on in New York and you know you're watching it, and the SEC comes in, what kind of thing would bring the SEC in? Would it be a high profile, a broad scope? What was it?
I say probably a little bit of each. You know, depends on the situation. I mean, sometimes if we knew that they were in a situation, we would back off, and I would hope that they did the same. Mm. You know.
Do you remember any instances like that where something big was going on and you were kind of watching what the SEC was doing? And
I can't recall at the time. Okay. Yeah.
Now, in the 60s, I guess, you know, Wall Street starts to crank up a little more, and there's a lot of activity, especially going into late in the decade. I mean, it's a real big time as far as securities industry is concerned. Did you see things change along with that economic activity? Did the level of fraud change, or the kinds of things that you started seeing?
What year are you talking about now?
Oh, moving from, you started in the late 50s. You were in there in 58 or so. And I'm thinking about moving into the mid to late 60s when the market's really taking off.
I don't think I recall anything that depended upon the markets taking off. I think that we were always involved with the with fraudulent and criminal activity. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it be a small case or an individual person or I'll give you an example. There was one case where we had a complaint by a person that she was asked to invest in a particular investment. I think it was had something to do with Ellis Island. And this particular gentleman, I guess he romanced her too, and got her to invest several hundred thousand dollars, I believe, in this particular venture. And we made our investigation and determined that this was a complete fraud, that there was nothing to do with Ellis Island, and that this guy was just giving her a load of beans. And so we determined that we would have to get him to get him on the record, so to speak. So we arranged that she would be meet him at a particular restaurant, and we put a wire on her. And I remember the incident. Actually, I was sitting outside in the car with a state trooper watching the restaurant, and we had two state troopers outside of the restaurant, and we had one of our female people also in the restaurant. And when the signal was given, the guys went in there and they grabbed him and they brought him back to the office. This was in my office at the World Trade Center. And the police that were assigned to me were right next to my office. And I came up and was in my office, and they were in their office, and they were, you know, taking the stuff out of his pockets and whatever police would do when they arrest somebody. And during the course of that, I guess the guy tried to be friendly, and he says, "Look, I got look," and he pushes his eyeball in, and out pops his eye. And he says, "This is what the girl apparently had a diamond placed in his eyeball, fake eyeball, phone, you know, not a real eyeball, yeah, but, you know." Yeah. And he pulled it out and showed it to the detectives. So that's the kind of stuff you had to deal with.
Jeez. There's no way to be prepared for something like that.
I guess not.
Well, moving on into the 70s, I know that some of the things you got involved with, well, you were talking about tantalum, you know, and one of the things when inflation started to hit, people were buying metals, people were buying all kinds of things to hedge against inflation.
Yeah.
Did you see any?
Well, there was a lot of gold being sold. Is that's maybe what you're talking about, or maybe
silver,
gold and silver. And they were, for instance, we had the these fellows who were down in Florida. The name was the Gold Bullion Exchange. I think it was International Gold Bullion Exchange, IGBE. IGBE was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and they had this huge skyscraper with a big sign, IGBE, and they advertised in the newspapers, the New York Times, all over the country about IGBE and the buying the gold, gold and silver, and we saw all this going on, and we hadn't gotten many complaints about any, you know, inappropriate activity, but we figured there was something wrong with this. And
you saw the ads?
Oh, yeah, of course we saw the ads, and the newspaper, the radios, everything was a big operation. And so we had them come into our office to discuss this matter with them, and they came in with an entourage, actually. I don't think there was a lawyer involved, but they came in by themselves, and the head of the operation, his name I forget at this particular point, and he had two or three other people with him, and he had this one particular good-looking young guy, and he was seated in my conference room, and the guy tells me, he says, "You see that guy over there?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "He's going to be the president." I said, "Oh, that's nice. You got someone to take your place when it's time for you to go?" He says, "No, I'm talking about the United States. He's going to be the president of the United States." In all seriousness, and I could tell at that point that these guys were high on drugs, absolutely high on drugs. And And they were just amazing, you know, what they were doing. And so we were trying to get the people down in Florida, the prosecutors down in Florida. I went down there and tried to convince them that they should carry the ball. This was a Florida operation, and to no avail. We finally had to indict them in Westchester County, and by that time, the Alderdice boys were less one. One was he was put in jail, and then he got out of jail and he committed suicide or something like that.
Alderdice?
Alderdice. Alderice.
Okay.
And actually, a couple of brothers were involved. I was reading in the office when he came into the office. I was reading him the literature that he had put out, and is it true what it says over here? And he says, yes, it's true. Yes, it's true. It turns out he didn't know what I was saying because he was half blind. He was a blind guy. He was blind. He couldn't even read his own literature.
So, again, you've got people who are selling shares or saying, we've got a warehouse full and you want to buy X pounds or something like that. And we'll keep it for you.
Right.
I mean, did you ever wonder about the folks who bought into things like this, where they're giving somebody lots of money to keep something for them months or years?
Unfortunately, that's a very common occurrence. I mean, I'm sure that it's happening today, especially when you've got the economics of the situation today. It's probably rife for boiler rooms and others to make pitches about some unusually good investment that's can be proof against anything going wrong in the economics of the situation. You know, you got a special kind of investment for them to handle this downturn in the market. And I'm sure they're out there doing it right now.
Hmm. You had a counterpart, or there would have been a state securities regulator in Florida that you would have spoken to in about this Alderdice situation.
Yes, we did.
Would it have been unusual for this person, the securities people down there, to just turn a blind eye to this, or was that something that happened pretty regularly?
Well, I wouldn't call it a blind eye. I think that the securities regulator in Florida is part of another office. I've forgotten it's Department of Commerce and so, and they didn't have the kind of authority and the hands-on ability to do something about this. It would have been probably impossible for them to do it. The prosecutors down there, the federal prosecutors or the state prosecutors, they certainly could have put a handle on that rather quickly, but they didn't do that for whatever reason. I don't know. We were we went down there, and I was the chief person to go down there and try to convince them that this had to be done, and they didn't do it. And so finally we had to do it. We had to indict them up here when it was happening down there.
Let's talk a little bit about that, the idea of New York having this different situation. The idea that your securities people in New York could actually go in and you had some teeth.
Yeah.
And I guess the Martin Act is behind all of this.
Correct.
Is that right? I mean, I've read about merit states and talked to folks about merit states and other forms of regulation, but there seems to be a consensus that New York is out here all by itself with the Martin Act and is somehow different. Can you tell me a little bit about that, about how New York State, compares and contrasts with some of the other state regulatory regimes?
Well, the Martin Act is actually sui generis. It is all by itself, so to speak. It's it does have direct criminal prosecutorial powers. It doesn't have to ask anybody. The Attorney General does not have to ask anybody. Any federal prosecutor, any state prosecutor to go into a criminal situation, go into a criminal court, go before a grand jury, go and seek an indictment and then prosecute the indictment in a local court. That's a tremendous amount of power that the Attorney General in New York has with respect to securities fraud prosecution. No other state has that, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And there may be a state where you can, the state regulator can go and ask the prosecutor to do something. But that's different when we are the prosecutors and we determine that we're going to do it. I'm talking about we're, but I'm no longer we're.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that direct power that we have that makes it made us pretty powerful and pretty good in making significant cases because we had this direct authority.
Did you have the ability that a merit state would have had to look at a prospectus and say this is no good, you can't sell stock in this?
Well, intrastate offerings, I think we finally got that kind of jurisdiction, but generally that was not the big problem. The big problem was the boiler rooms, the outright frauds, you know, not some whether you had to determine whether a prospectus should have said X rather than Y, and did you dot the T here and cross the I there or whatever.
Right.
You know, we weren't interested in that sort of thing. Real estate, however, was a different. There was a time when real estate ventures became very troublesome, okay? And that's when we prosecuted real estate frauds. And eventually there was some real estate requirements were put into the Martin Act to address that situation. Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we just talked about the Martin Act a little bit and how the power, your ability to be a prosecutor essentially was unusual. And was even broadened at some point to where you could.
Yeah, we were able to go. For instance, we were in the office building, the what is now the Louis Lefkowitz office building on the corner of Worth Street, right next to the Tombs Prison and the criminal courts building, and we used to go right across the street into the. Grand jury room and ask for grand jury time and just, you know, make our presentations. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it was very easy. We didn't have to ask for we just asked the district attorney to give us time before the grand jury, and then we carried the ball from that on.
So in New York, you weren't sitting around looking at filings and basically vetting every securities deal that somebody wanted to do.
Not in general. The real estate syndicate section used to do that. Eventually, that came into being, yes. But I was sort of out of the real estate syndication bureau. Okay. And that was a separate bureau, and they had their own things that to do with respect to some of the filings and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And condominiums became a big thing, the sale of condominiums and how that would be handled. And to this day, it's a big industry. You know, the real estate syndication, there's a lot of legalities that you have to go through with respect to through the Attorney General's office, but that was sort of a split off from the Security Frauds Bureau.
Okay. But it's a similar kind of exercise to what people might have done.
But they were more involved, I would say, less criminal posture, you know, anti-criminal posture, but mm-hmm. more in what the prospectus would say or not say and how they carried out what it said or didn't say. If they didn't do what they were supposed to do, then they, you know, what brought before the, you know, whoever was in charge of taking care of the situation.
Right. But in your securities branch, you were looking for criminals generally.
We were looking for fraud. Yeah. And if it was a criminal fraud, yes, we were looking. We wanted to make sure that the message was clear that you couldn't operate without some kind of fear in New York City with respect to your fraudulent activities.
Mm-hmm. So that was the theory behind regulations New York.
Absolutely.
Is show everybody that we're serious, we mean.
Yeah.
What's the difference between criminal fraud and non-criminal fraud? You made that distinction.
Well, criminal fraud is, you know, someone says that what he's selling is XYZ, and he knows it's not XYZ. Or someone says, someone selling something to you that says, you know, it's not quite as virulent as what you would think it is. In other words, you're asking me what's the difference between criminal fraud and non-criminal fraud?
Yeah.
Well, there are definitions of that somewhere in the books, you know, but we wanted to get the criminal frauds, the ones that were absolute fraudulent.
Right.
You know, if a person says, well, you should get 50 cents on a gallon of gasoline and it's only 55, well, maybe it's fraudulent, but it's not criminal fraud.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I don't know if I've answered your question or not.
Yeah, well, I can see where there would be shades of gray.
Well, so if you didn't, as a prosecutor, if you didn't feel that this person was subject to going to jail, that what he did wasn't that bad, so to speak, then it wasn't a criminal fraud. Maybe that's the way to put it.
Yeah. Okay.
But if he said something that was wrong, but it wasn't purposeful, it wasn't, you know, that he definitely wanted to confuse somebody and to take this money away from him, that's a different story.
Yeah. And a little too much salesmanship. You don't want to put somebody in jail for
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, this makes sense then in light of what you said earlier about when you were doing, I guess it was the big case, you decided to prosecute every single salesman.
Right.
Because you wanted to send a message.
Right.
Did that work? Did that message get heard? And did boiler room activity slow down?
Absolutely. Absolutely. After that period of time, there were no boiler rooms in New York, New York State, in the city, or usually we were in Long Island.
Okay.
They flew the coop, so to speak. They really did. And we attributed to that criminal prosecution of not only the principals of the firm, but also the individual salespeople. The salespeople were not going to take the chance that this guy was telling that this is right or wrong, that he's going to go to jail if the guy was wrong.
Mm-hmm. What are the chances that they went to Connecticut or they went to, you know, New Jersey?
There were boiler rooms in New Jersey. Yeah, but I don't, at this particular point in time, I don't remember whether they ceased operation in Jersey also because of our prosecution. I don't think so. But they certainly stopped in New York State as far as I remember.
Yeah. And that was your major concern, I guess.
Correct.
Well, that gets to the whole, you know, the whole issue of states maybe working together instead of separately. And I wonder when you got involved with any state securities groups. I know NASA came along. Well, NASA had been around for a long time. It started to get active in the 70s. When did you start to get involved?
Well, I had to look at my calendars to find out exactly when I got involved, but I could recall that when I was appointed a bureau chief, and I think...
That was in 75.
Summer's around there, yeah. Someone must have called me up from NASA, and they asked me if I would be the treasurer for NASA. And I knew what NASA was because my predecessors had gone to their conventions, usually in Mexico or some nice place like that. And so I knew of the existence of NASA, and they asked me if I would become the treasurer. So I says, yes, I'll become. What does it involve? And they said, well, it's not that much. He says, you got to collect the dues or the fees from each individual state regulator and, you know, put them in a bank account, and that's about it. So I said, that sounds pretty easy. So that's what I did. I mean, there was 50 states. There was $100 a year for the dues. So I collected 100 times 50, which was, I don't know, $5,000. And that was the NASA treasury. And I was the president or treasurer for, I think, 1 year. And then I dropped out of it. I mean, I wasn't a treasurer anymore. But, you know, of course, NASA became big when they devised the uniform securities, the uniform salesman exam and that sort of thing. And then the fees in connection therewith, and then, of course, the Treasury got to be quite substantial to this day. Yeah. Now they don't have one state administrator collecting $100, but they have many thousands of dollars, and they have a big office in Washington, D.C., and God bless them, they do okay.
And it's based on the fees that are charged.
Generated by the CS, yeah. Yes.
Things like the uniform security exam, was that a welcome development in New York State? Had you been administering your own exam?
No, we didn't have any exams at all.
Okay.
We did not. That came in with the new regime. You know, everybody has to take the uniform securities exam now, including
right.
New York.
Right.
Yeah, but
right.
There was no
New York exam?
No, not at all. There was no salesman requirement until later, you know.
So anybody could sell securities in New York?
Correct.
Okay.
There was no licensing requirement for salespeople.
Huh.
You know, when I first started, eventually it came.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, did seeing as how this is a pretty generally accepted thing elsewhere, was there ever any thought of doing that in New York State?
Of making a salesman?
Of licensing securities dealers, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, certainly not licensing the salesman. I think the dealers, there was a routine sort of a paper filing of who was selling securities in the state, but it wasn't too well enforced.
Okay. Well, once you became treasurer and you're a fellow state securities regulator with these folks, did you become active in NASA and begin to serve
later,
on committees?
Later on I did, yeah. Later on I did become active, yes. And I became... I think I was a treasurer, I was a secretary, I was on the board for several years, I was a chairman of some committees, and I think I became relatively quite active, I think that we did a good job, I mean, as far as that's concerned. I was in at the beginning of the burgeoning of the regulation of securities on a statewide basis, national statewide basis. And we had some good people there in the office.
Well, this was essentially a way to bring ideas together and share ideas. Is that right?
Yeah, it was, and there was a lot of young people there who were very interested in protecting the investing public, and they did a good job. We did a good job.
Yeah, because New York State's so different. I mean, a lot of probably the majority of those folks at NASA were looking at things like, looking at the merits of an issuance and things like that. Because New York's so different, what kinds of things were you able to bring to NASA, and conversely, what kinds of things did you learn what kinds of expertise could you bring away from NASA?
Well, I would hope to think that our criminal prosecutorial powers and the way we implemented them was a benefit to my NASA colleagues who did not have that kind of direct ability. And I think that we did have certain, we had different venues where we discussed things like that. And I think that gradually, maybe I'm incorrect, but I think gradually they themselves have sort of lean towards criminal prosecution. Maybe they can't do it themselves, but they can go to, they have more, I think, a better feeling of going to the appropriate prosecutorial agency to enforce their laws as much as they possibly can in the criminal sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I know folks that I've talked to, that has been the case, where there have been certain issues where they've decided that they were going to take it on, and they get with, you know, prosecuting attorneys. And
correct. I think that's been a great step forward as far as that's concerned with respect to state regulation in general. And I think that what we sort of mirrored or gave to them in our interaction with them, even though we weren't a merit state or a state that relied basically on filing of papers, etc., and the full disclosure and that kind of stuff, we were more in the criminal prosecutorial and also in the civil prosecutorial, injunctive relief sort of things. Mm-hmm. But I think that they sort of learned a little bit, at least from us. And, of course, subsequent to my exit from the state scene, of course, I went to work for Merrill Lynch and try to present the problems of the industry with respect to state regulation. I mean, I now had a different viewpoint of what state regulation should or should not be, and I think without trying to invade the ability to prosecute appropriately those who are need to be prosecuted. So I think that I did take that stance when I was with Merrill Lynch, and to try to bring that forth to the NASA community, that there are things that are not necessarily always true with respect to how you could. There's a difference between regulating a boiler room and regulating a legitimate firm, because you'll find that the legitimate firms are in favor of good prosecution of criminals in the securities business. Mm-hmm. and they want to make sure that the public knows that they're a legitimate operation. Merrill Lynch wanted to know, wants its customers to know, that it's a legitimate operation. Not to say that occasionally you find someone that goes off the beat. Right. But, you know, the focus of the legitimate firms on Wall Street is to be good citizens and do the right thing and not commit fraud. And I was there to try to indoctrinate that or to bring that forth to the state regulators when I took my position with Merrill Lynch.
Okay. So they brought you on to sort of talk to the state regulators and establish communications.
Establish communications and to bring things to their attention that I thought needed to be brought. There was the ombudsman. The NASA instituted this procedure of having an ombudsman where the industry presumably would come to the ombudsman and complain about some particular thing, you know, that was not being done correctly or was overboard or whatever. So I would naturally attend these ombudsman's meeting and put all my my complaints or whatever on. And it was a very interesting experience.
Now this is like in the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how would NASA respond to this?
I hope.
Yeah. Did you ever see any, you know, yes, sir, we'll see what we can do and see something actually?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. I can't remember exactly what it was now, but yes, there was give and take there, and it was appropriate. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I want to come back to that a little bit, but I want to catch up on some of the things from your career as a state regulator too. In the 70s, you had the Williams Act. In the decade, you had a lot of corporate takeovers. And I know a lot of the state regulators were pretty involved in the whole issue of hostile tender offers and looking at takeovers. I saw somewhere that you had actually helped to draft a Takeover Disclosure Act in New York State. Do you remember anything about that time and that issue?
Yeah, the Takeover Disclosure, it was pretty a hot issue. I don't know if I drafted a bill for New York particularly, but I think it was a model draft of takeover state okay. takeover statutes.
That's something else I want to get yeah. to, too, is that whole model draft idea. Yeah. Tell me about that and what the point of that was.
Well, I have some difficulty recalling the specifics of it, but I know I was the chairman of the committee.
Right.
We had a bunch of... fellows, and I think maybe some ladies too, who went to meetings and drafted a particular, what we thought would be an appropriate Takeover Disclosure Act, which was at that time subject, I believe, to a lot of criticism, if not really attacks, to completely obliterate the necessity. And I think that we were trying to sort of get in between and resolve some of the differences so that there wouldn't be a complete disappearance of a takeover disclosure situation. And I think that finally it just went its way, right? It just never...
Right. The Supreme Court struck down one of the state...
Yeah, Edgar versus Mike.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, Illinois.
Yeah.
Which sort of let loose this whole...
Yes. And I think I was involved in drafting some of the proposals that we had that NASA had with respect to that Edgar versus Mike
right.
case. I think I was involved with that too.
How much of that discussion, I don't know if you remember, but how much of that discussion had to do with the SEC and what the SEC was doing?
Oh, I think was a lot. I think that we sort of felt, and maybe I'm wrong, but I thought we thought that we were on a different side than the SEC mm-hmm. with respect to that. I think they were on the other side.
So the idea was that you would draft this model legislation that other states supposedly could adopt.
Yeah, well, you know, the NASA had its individual committees, and one of the committees was the Takeover Disclosure Act Committee, and mm-hmm. I was the chairman of it, and the purpose was to propose appropriate legislation, model legislation, and that's what we did.
Did you do that in other areas, too? I know you were on a number of committees over the years.
Yes, I did, but I don't know if I can tell you that offhand. I think that financial planning did come up sort of out of the blue, so to speak. All of a sudden, I was getting calls from different societies and groups of financial planners and so forth for me to speak at different events and so forth and so on. I remember having vigorous arguments with some of them and some of them not so vigorous. And so there was quite a bit of activity going on in that connection, and I did become at one point, I think, the head of the Financial Planning Committee for NASA and probably propose some sort of a statute or regulation, I don't recall exactly.
Was there any sense why this had suddenly become a big issue?
Well, because I think part of the financial planning thing was also fraud. I think there was, as a matter of fact, now that I think I'm starting to recall, we had a big financial planning prosecution up in Albany, which involved financial planners, and our staff spent a lot of time up in the Albany area prosecuting that case.
One of the areas of emphasis for other people was to license these guys, to make them take exams, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know, maybe that was part of the NASA recommendations. But again, in New York State, I guess you wouldn't take that approach. Is that right?
Probably not, yeah, but it probably would have been okay for most of the states, I guess, to make sure that the people were appropriately licensed and they were appropriately knew what they were doing by educational means. Yeah, a lot of these financial, so-called financial planners were nothing but thieves, and I think it was the first Meridian case. That was the case I think that involved financial planners in upstate New York. That's my best recollection.
Okay.
Slowly comes out.
Well, here's a bigger name, E.F. Hutton.
E.F. Hutton.
That's another one of those incidents from the 80s. Do you remember much about that particular case?
I do remember something, yes. I remember you know, that the problem coming up. The problem was something to do with how E.F. Hutton deposited its monies into the West Coast account and to carry the carry over to the East Coast, and they made some kind of a couple of points on their the way they did it type of thing. And I remember going with Dan Bell, who used to be the administrator in North Carolina. Dan and I went to, incidentally, Dan is a very knowledgeable young man who you should talk to. And anyway, he and I went to meet with the U.S. Attorney's office, and one particular fellow there who had investigated and was in the process of prosecuting E.F. Hutton. And
this is in New York?
No, this was in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Dan and I went out to find out what the story was all about, and I think he did eventually prosecute him, and actually that led to their demise. Of course, once, you know, major firm or any firm is indicted and eventually found guilty of investor fraud, I mean, he's out of business, either mm-hmm. legally or otherwise, and that's what happened to E.F. Hutton. They just went down the tube. As a result of this unfortunate practice that they had, and it was a pretty substantial, well-known firm.
Yeah,
you know, and I guess there must have been some hard reasoning on their part and of how to handle this indictment. That's what it was. They were indicted in the Pennsylvania court, and of course, if they ever were found guilty, they would automatically lose their license. And I guess the indictment was enough to send them into the doldrums.
Hmm. So were you thinking about getting NASA involved in this?
NASA was involved in that, yeah.
In what way?
I think there was a committee formed about E.F. Hutton. Yes, as a matter of fact, I participated in that. And we went down. There was a well-known Southern figure who was in charge, who was, I guess, hired maybe by E.F. Hutton to help them out in their problem. Anyway, there was a big meeting where this was discussed, and the NASA people were there. I can't remember the name of the... it's a very well-known name, but I can't remember it. From Arkansas or somewhere down there. Anyway, Hutton went under.
Well, this gets to, we were talking earlier about the gray area that you would encounter. I mean, E.F. Hutton was doing these overdrafts. They were doing bank overdrafts, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like they were necessarily defrauding investors or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, I guess there's some question there. If they're not defrauding investors, why are the state securities regulators looking at them? I wonder if that question came up.
Oh, it probably did. I don't think it was only the state regulators that were looking at them. I think the SEC was probably looking at them also, I would think. You know, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they were. In either event, it was bad news for E.F. Hutton, no matter what they did. You know, you got to understand that the legitimate firm that is a legitimate firm, but something happens when one particular aspect of it, of its existence, and somebody does something wrong, or a regulator takes action against them, it's pretty disastrous. You know, it's you can see a boiler room going out of business, but it's kind of hard to take. That's a lot more people are involved when you have a legitimate firm, and that legitimate firm goes under. There's a lot more people that you have to consider whether that's the appropriate way of handling the situation. So you got to be careful as to, the regulator has to be careful as to how it handles legitimate firms, because legitimate firms has its tentacles all over. And if somebody does something in Kalamazoo that's inappropriate, that could lead to their whole demise, that's not the way to go.
Right.
There's got to be some answer to that.
Did you have discussions like that in your office, where you're looking at some example of wrongdoing, and you're saying, but wait a minute, this is a bad apple way over here, you know, they put a lid on them right away, or whatever?
Yeah, I hope that I felt that way and I acted that way. Yes, I wouldn't take action against a brokerage house, you know, and put them out of business completely if it was limited to some one person or some particular office or something like that. I mean, you had to take everything into consideration. And some regulators now or recently have not had that capability of really realizing the implications of going against a legitimate firm for something that some part of the legitimate firm may have not done correctly. You can't, it's not appropriate, in my opinion, to put the whole firm out of business, whether it's by legal action or by just the implication of making it sound like this is a terrible firm because of what was done. Do I make sense at all?
Yeah. Well, given the authority that the Martin Act gives you, or gave you, it seems like there's a sense that you do have a heck of a lot of responsibility. You've got a really big...
That's exactly right.
You got a big hammer, and you have to be careful.
Yeah, and you got to how to hit it, right.
Yeah.
You don't want the nail to break when you're hitting it with the hammer.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Did you ever wish that you had some smaller instruments than just your big hammer?
Well, there are. You know, there's consent injunctions and that kind of stuff. You know, that. But even some of that is not, it depends how it's... Many of it depends on how it's brought to the public's attention, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you say that XYZ company did this and did that and did this, but the only thing that the regulator did was do this, a little tiny bit, but everybody knows what was said in the newspapers,
right?
And they're going, taking that stuff out of the company.
Right. Well,
and I don't know what the answer to that is, but it's got to be on the table, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, when a regulator wants to do something, he's got to realize what the extent of his powers are, and not just go for the headlines all the time, even though I certainly did that in my day, go for the headlines, but I hope that I didn't do it inappropriately.
Yeah. Well, I guess you were looking at some desired effect, like making salesmen decide not to take jobs with boiler rooms,
yeah,
things like that.
Yeah.
You had the criminal where you would bring people to court and try to send them to jail, but you also had this injunctive relief and things like that. Was the criminal stuff in the minority, was that a pretty small amount? Would you generally bring proceedings and make somebody stop doing whatever it was?
Well, you know, I don't know. I never took account as to how many criminal proceedings and how many injunctive. I know we had much more injunctive proceedings than criminal proceedings, certainly, because usually those were, you know, consented to. And it was easier to get, so to speak, you know. But if you had to go to, you couldn't ask a person that you wanted to really do a number on to say, well, you want to plead guilty to a felony? No, thank you, you know.
Yeah.
But if you offered them maybe a, you know, two-year injunction or something, maybe you'll think about it, which we didn't do. We usually didn't. It was either all or nothing at all type of thing, either a permanent injunction or nothing, you know. That's basically what our principles were.
Oh, okay. So you seldom had these two-year injunctions.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
There was I remember reading about a case, and it might have been in one of those bulletins, news releases, where you had some guy that you served an injunction down in Brazil or something like that.
Oh, yes.
And he came back and said, well, you know, this is not permanent. This is...
Yeah, Charles Stahl.
Yeah.
That was an amazing case. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, if you remember it. He was a Swiss or something like that?
Yeah, he was a... He was certainly European. I don't know if he was Swiss, but he was with Swiss bankers. I know that. Mm-hmm. And that was an amazing case. He was sort of like a mystery man, a European mystery man, and he apparently had established Green Bay Mining Company, which was listed on the Edmonton Stock Exchange, and he was also affiliated with a company called DuPonte and Company, which was a supposedly legitimate firm in New York and Switzerland, etc. And all of a sudden, the overnight collapse of the company of Green Bay Mining came about, and there was all kinds of articles in the newspaper. He fled to Brazil. He was coming back. He had a publicist I went to see. He was coming by airplane back from Brazil, and he was going to make a statement in LaGuardia or someplace. And I went out to listen to him and hear what he had to say. And there was a guy named John Van Allen who was a sort of a European mystery man, and he was involved with that, and Senator McCarthy and Senator Brewster were received stock of these companies. Mm. And it was a very interesting case. And actually, Frank Costello was supposed to be involved with it too, and we called in Frank Costello to testify, and he naturally invoked his privilege again. He came in all by himself, actually, without a lawyer or anything. Just walked in the door like you wouldn't know this guy from a hole in the ground.
So he just stopped by your office?
No. We got in touch with him and he with his lawyer or something. He came in without a lawyer and came in, and then we asked him questions and he refused to answer. And mm-hmm. and that's, there was nothing else we could do at that point. And because we were just trying to figure out what his connection was, where we could never prove anything. And remember the other gentleman that was in the office with me, actually Costello came over and shook hands with both of us. And the other fellow went to the, it was a sink, and he washed his hands right away.
Well, so the idea was that he'd agreed to an injunction.
Yes.
This guy Stahl, I guess.
Yeah, Charles Stahl.
And then he contested. Later on, he contested.
He did, yes. And he was unsuccessful. And he started up some sort of a business in Philadelphia, I think. Some kind of a Greens newsletter or something like that. And continued to do whatever he was doing. He always protested that he was innocent of any of the charges. And
But as long as he was doing business in Philadelphia, he was okay.
He was okay.
He just couldn't come back.
Because I think we actually enjoined him, or he consented to an injunction from doing any business in the state of New York. That's what it was. And he tried, I think, to overturn it or something, and unsuccessfully, perhaps. And then he opened up this newsletter in New Jersey. And then he just sort of lost track of him. Yeah.
Okay.
But that was quite a case, too.
I came across some other ones. I don't know if you'll remember them. There's one called Southwest Chemical and Iron, where apparently they were selling stock or something like that, and somehow you found out they didn't have a factory, or they had a factory, but there was nothing inside or something to that effect.
Well, it's Very probable, but I don't remember it.
Yeah. All right. And there's one more, which Carla asked me to bring up, which was you provided some documents that had to do with flying saucers and some sort of scam involving flying saucers.
Yeah. Do
you remember anything about that?
I remember her bringing it to my attention, but I don't remember much about it.
Well, that's on the list.
It had something to do with somebody was, some shtick with respect to flying saucers. At that point, I guess flying saucers were the thing, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember the details.
It was all about coming up with the right story, I guess.
I think you're right. I think at that point you had a good story. I mean, you were working for people who were elected to office, and you had to come up with stories, but whether they were gigantic stories, which involved thousands and thousands of people, or maybe one person who got swindled that made a good story. And there's nothing wrong with that. The little guy is entitled to whatever the New York Securities Bureau could do for him too. Put a little pressure on a guy, get his money back. That's okay. You don't have to enjoin him or put him in jail, but just politely ask him, hey, give the guy your money back.
Right.
And that's probably why we may have had a press release on it too. I don't know.
When did you decide to retire from the securities group in New York State?
I was reaching my retirement age, I guess, in the Attorney General's office. I think it was 55, probably. 55, and this is an interesting story. I decided I was going to seek employment elsewhere, and I went to several places. I went to a headhunter,
mm-hmm.
and she told me that I should go to people that I knew and try to tell them that I was looking, and so forth and so on. I went to one particular place. I think she might have sent me to, I guess she did. She sent me to this well-known lawyer who had just opened up, become a partner in a major New York law firm whose name I forgot. And his name I've forgotten, but he was very well-known. And I went into his office. Somehow I got the appointment, and he was sitting behind this huge desk and an opulent sort of place. And he was behind a desk. He had rings all over his fingers. He was just incredible. And he asked me what my curriculum vitae looked like. And and I came back and I told my wife, I says, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to get that job.
Don't have enough rings?
Yeah. And but then the lady who was my headhunter, she said, you better make sure you've got people that you can say recommend you. I said, oh, that's a good idea. I said, I got Stanley Sporkin, I got Steve Hammerman, and I named a third person, I forget what. So she said, well, you better call them up and tell them that you're going to use their name, which I did. So I called up Stanley and this other person. I called up Steve Hammerman, who was at that point with Merrill Lynch. So he said, oh, yeah, Rusty, that's good. That's good. So meanwhile, in a few days or the next day, I get a call from one of his associates and says, Orestes is looking for a position. So that's how I got the position.
Mm.
It just happenstance, because the lady told me to get some good recommendations, and they went to Steve and got it.
It's all about knowing someone.
Yeah, I guess so.
How did you know Stanley Sporkin? When did you work with him?
Well, we worked with him when I was with the AG's office on several matters all the time. He was a good guy.
When he was doing enforcement?
Yeah, he was a good guy. As a matter of fact, we had a case involving the American Stock Exchange. And American Stock Exchange, you want me to tell you that story?
Sure.
They came out with a press release, I guess it was an article in the newspaper that said basically that they had painted the tape. They had put something on the tape that was not true.
Amex said that they had done that.
The release that they put out stated that, okay. to that effect.
Yeah. Huh.
And I thought that was outrageous. And I just couldn't figure it out. Here's a major firm saying this, admitting it, basically, I think. So I called up Stanley. And I said, Stanley, X, Y, and Z. And I says, I like to do something about this. I want to go against them criminally. And Stanley says, yeah, go ahead. He says, basically he said this, he agreed with me. Mm-hmm. Let me get the story straight here. So we decided we were going to go ahead with it, and we had a wire put on one of our police guys and engaged in a conversation with someone from the Amex on the street. Exactly how that happened, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But when he got back to the office, the wind was so high that it was unintelligible. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have the proof enough to go for a criminal prosecution. And we settled less than that, punitive mm-hmm. thing against the Amex.
You brought somebody in from Amex and here's the deal. And
Yeah.
What kind of punitive damages or?
I've forgotten. Okay. I've forgotten.
Well, that gets to an interesting question. One of the things with the SEC, of course, is that, you know, there's this period in the 70s where enforcement is everything, you know, and under Stanley Sorkin.
Oh, Sorkin.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. We liked him. The states liked him.
Yeah, I guess.
We used to go at the, you know, in the NASA, talking about NASA conventions and NASA meetings. Every springtime, there would be a NASA meeting in Washington. You know, they'd have the SEC come in and give a talk and this and that. And then, you know, we used to go upstairs to the hotel room and play pinochle, you know, mm-hmm. you know, just for fun. Mm-hmm. It was Stanley. And
when he brought this change, when this change came to the SEC and it's taking a more activist role in enforcement, did that make a difference for you in changing the general tenor within the industry at all?
I think, I mean, my own personal, I think that I welcomed it. Mm-hmm. I didn't say, hey, well, Stanley's going overboard, or he shouldn't be taking my turf. No, yeah. There was plenty of stuff to go around.
Yeah.
Everybody had enough to do, you know. Uh-huh. So, no, I didn't think that was bad.
Were relations between the states and the SEC pretty good at that
point? I think so, yes. Okay. I believe so.
And did they stay on? You talked sort of in general about how there's this inevitable tension between the federal and the state regulators. But apparently.
Well, yeah, the tension, when, you know, some of the SEC people, they were like, it's all mine type of thing. Mm-hmm. It's my case. And we said, it's my case. And, you know, you had a little give and take there, you know.
So it's as much personal as anything else,
yeah,
I guess.
True. Yeah, true.
Okay. Well, is there anything that we haven't covered that...
Probably so, but I don't...
All right, well, if there is, we'll talk on the phone and pick it back up.
Very good.
Appreciate you talking to me.
Nice to be with you.